This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 97th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and we're pleased to have today with us Aaron Bedra. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. Aaron Bedra is a software security guy at Groupon and a member of the Clojure Core. He's held positions at Cigital, Braintree, Relevance, and Artigan as both a developer and as a software security expert. Aaron specializes in agile methodologies and their real-world application with a side of software security. Aaron lives with his wife, Erin, in the Chicago area. He has a BA from Bowling Green State University, and he plays a mean bass guitar. So thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Part of the challenge of software security is getting developers engaged and caring. So
yes.
How is security viewed in development teams that you've been involved with?
You know, I guess it's a mixed bag. Some teams I've seen are just, they're on the right track. They're thinking about security all the time. And others, it's just a roadblock for them to get whatever they're trying to do done. And so I've run the gamut across, I think, all of it at this point. It's interesting to see how things have shifted over the past several years,
mm-hmm.
especially after some of the big breaches that have happened, big bugs, of course, Heartbleed being something interesting.
Yeah, we can talk about that later on.
Yeah. So I guess I've kind of seen it all.
Yeah. So tell us about a situation where the dev team guys either were afraid of security or tried to hide from them or didn't want to talk to them or hated them or whatever.
You know, I think one of the biggest obstacles I've seen has actually been in the mobile space, as far as recently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you submit something to the App Store, right, for Apple, once that's submitted, it's going to go. And resubmitting, re-releasing, it's a big process.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to sort that out, from a security perspective after they've submitted is always a tough thing, right?
I see.
And so you get the submitting to the App Store, and then they say, oh, hey, can we have a security review? And you say, well, of course. Then you find something big, and then all of a sudden you say, well, we got to fix this. And they say, well, we can't. We've already submitted to the App Store. It'll have to go out in the next release.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have that kind of moment where you have to think about whether or not it's critical enough to hold the release or let it go through. And you know, you really want to err towards letting the release go and
right.
getting another one out the door soon
right.
so that you don't stop things.
Right. So sometimes software security does do that. They put a hold on everything. They come in at the last minute and kind of blow stuff up. And that just makes all the developers mad because you think you're done. You think your baby's ready to go. And somebody comes in and says it has three arms, which is not,
that's
not,
right.
not so good. So what do you think software security types, as just in general, can do differently to engage developers more clearly in terms that they understand?
For me, I think it's being a developer. There seems to be, there's this divide between the security group or the software security group and the development team.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason for that. All the teams that I put together, my number one requirement is they pass the development interview. Mm-hmm. If the dev team won't hire them, neither will I.
Right.
There needs to be a mutual respect. And I think we have a really big breakdown in mutual respect. And I think that's one of the, the big kind of roadblocks that we see across, companies is, there's no respect from the security team across to the development team and no respect, back the other way as well.
Sort of bi-directional.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one of the big things. It's a people problem, just like everything else is. It boils down to people problems, and mutual respect is huge.
Right. So I've always said that software security people should be taken from the ranks of development and turned into security people and not the other way around. I think you can do it the other way around. It's just way, way harder.
I agree, yes.
So, if you were a security person and you wanted to start doing software security, say, what would the number one thing be to do to learn about software and to learn about programming and all that jazz?
I really think it comes down to two camps, right? Understanding, pick a language, right?
Yeah.
It's great to learn at least one language. Of course, you'll need to know more down the road, but pick a language. and also understand some stuff about software engineering, right? The discipline, the practice, the stuff that goes into making software versus just writing code
right.
or typing on a screen.
Right.
You know, the syntax of a language is you know, a 20th of what you need to produce an actual piece of working software.
do you think so. It's good to get involved? I mean, are there projects that budding software security types who are really from security can get involved with to learn about how real code works?
Absolutely. I mean, and there's actually a bunch of really great pieces of open source software around security, right? The Social Engineering Toolkit, Metasploit, you know, Nmap, you know, all kinds of different stuff, tools that we use every day as security professionals. A lot of them are open source software as well. And so you can kind of take that interest you have in security and turn around and look at the, you know, the different languages they're built in. You know, Social Engineering Toolkit is a Python app, Metasploit's Ruby, Nmap is C++. You know, there's lots of different things. You kind of take your pick and try to sort that out. But I think it's important to find something that works for you. I'm not sure I'd recommend starting with C. I think it's something everybody should understand at some point. But
it's easier to find problems in C, though, I think.
It certainly is, yes.
If you can understand what the hell's going on.
I think C is like Go. It's 5 minutes to learn and a lifetime to master.
Exactly. Let's turn the same question around. What can developers do if they want to get a better handle on software security?
Absolutely. You know, I think there's some really great books that are out there. You know, I think there's, likewise, like with security folks getting into software, there's the ideology, philosophy, the pieces that make up software security. And then there's the, you know, just the hardcore, the details of security.
Right.
So, you know, focusing on just software security, right, I think there's things that are specific to different genres, but I do like the Web Application Attacker's Handbook as kind of a way to start to learn how to attack an app, how to test. The WebGoat projects are fun. More of those are coming out. I think there's WebGoat, RailsGoat, and I think there's an iOS and our Android version coming out soon as well, if not one already. But I think there's some good stuff there. You know, I do like the software security book, your book. I think that it's got a lot of good stuff around philosophy, right? How thinking, understanding, creating groups, that kind of stuff is really important to understand kind of how it all functions.
Right, how it all gets put together. And then I know this is a sort of a softball question, but what's more important, tools or culture?
Oh, culture. 100% everyday culture.
Right. So instituting a culture of security is the real challenge, ultimately.
Yes.
Whether you're
coming
from security or dev, we all have to work together and fix the culture so that everybody's building the right sort of software.
Yeah.
All right. Programming languages have an outsized impact on security, as you've already alluded to. C and C++ are pretty much a huge mess. Java and .NET and C# are better in many senses because of type safety, and Ruby and Python and JavaScript present new challenges. Let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, what is the problem with C? Why is it that all those security people are always complaining about C?
Well, I mean, it just boils down to understanding, right? You know, you can learn C very quickly. The language is simple, right? There's not much to it. There's not a lot you have to understand to use the C language to get a program to compile. But there's the infinite amount of things that you can do wrong because it's so close to the system. There's no managed runtime.
Mm-hmm.
You control your own memory management. You know, architecture changes, systems change. What works on one system and one architecture, one even CPU type might change to another, right? That assembly, the assembler that gets written out is not the assembler that gets run on the machine anymore, right? The CPU is rewriting those instructions, that's optimizing them. You know, if you want to write C code and systems level C code, you really have to understand the architecture of the system you're running it on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much additional baggage that you have to, it comes along with C, right? And so to be a good C or C++ developer, you really have to get the entire stack all the way down to the hardware.
Right. I always think of it as assembly language on steroids, really.
Sure, sure.
And there's some things that you want to build with that amount of power. But with that amount of power comes a lot of responsibility, I guess. And I'd say what you said before, starting with C, probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
I think I started with AppleSoft Basic back in 1981.
Basic was my first language as well, actually.
And then I moved all the way on to Turbo Pascal. Woohoo.
So, oh, no.
So why are type safe languages a good idea? What is type safety anyway?
Well, I mean, I think you can categorize type safety in a few different ways. You've got, I think, the approach from the C# and Java camp where there's types in the language, there's generics in the language. You have kind of some of the basic building blocks, and if the types don't align, the program won't compile. And mm-hmm. So it's supposed to, of course, keep you from making really obvious mistakes in your code, passing something to a function or a method that has no business being there, right, that would make the code explode. And then you have some of your kind of more adventurous jumps into type safety with something like Haskell, Scala, AGDA, IDRIS, those languages that are very, very strong in the type theory department as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're getting programming language with the side of category theory.
So the whole idea behind type safety is an object of a certain sort, of a certain type, will always have that type. And when you have transformations on those types, it's guaranteed to produce a certain type as well. And that allows you to prove things about your code. That's the whole idea.
That's the whole idea, right? And in that Haskell, AGDA, camp, that really is the goal too. They're closer and closer to a correctly compiled piece of software is a provably correct piece of code.
Right.
And that's interesting academically, but it can present some interesting challenges in production in real world software.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's that trade-off again. You want the power of C? Well, you have to take the risk of using that language. And, if you're a kindergartner with a circular saw, you might just saw your own little hand off.
You probably will, yes.
Let's talk about one other programming language's concept, and that is the concept of closure. What is a closure, and why is that important?
So when you say a closure, you're talking about the construct, not the closure language,
right? That's right. We're going to do the closure language next.
Okay, cool. Oh, yeah. So
this is a closure with an S.
Yes, and not the Google closure.
Right.
Closures are one of the most important concepts for me personally in programming. There's so much additional power you get out of having a closure in a language. I mean, just having the ability to have that finite scoping, having the ability to, pass them around as kind of bags of information mm-hmm. that really have their own scope. I mean, that's the killer feature for me.
So explain it to somebody who doesn't know anything about programming languages, but they understand variables and stuff.
Yeah, so if you were to assign, foo to a value in a function, and then you were going to create, let's say, some kind of iterator inside a function, or maybe you might return another function outside of the immediate function you're in, and you wanted to make sure that you might modify that foo variable that you've assigned earlier in your function, and you want to make sure it's not messed with, it's kind of copied over, and really what's called closed over, right? Mm-hmm. Inside of the executing scope of the function. Basically, what it's going to do is create a little wrapper, a little universe, or environment around this particular invocation, right? Whether it's a for loop or a function return or something like that, right? It's going to create that little mini environment, mini universe, and the scope of that variable will be contained only in that little universe and not to the external world.
Right. So the idea is nobody can screw around with your variables without you knowing about it.
That's exactly right.
So if you think about a function that is a function of x and y, and x and y are not bound, there's no closure. That is, you just add x and y, but x and y could come from anywhere, and people can change them around. That's not a closure. But if you set x to 3 and y to 2, and then you bake the thing, you can make a closure that way. That's a very simple version of closure. But that's the whole concept. So that's important because then we can once again have some guarantees about what code is going to do. If we have it very open-ended, it's unclear what the code is going to do. It makes proving stuff and making security guarantees and safety guarantees much more difficult.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So now let's talk about Clojure.
Sure. I mean, so Clojure, the language, takes after my favorite universe of languages, the Lisp world. It is a Lisp dialect. It's a bit different. It draws a lot of its Lispy inspiration from Common Lisp. Mm-hmm. The macro system is you know, heavily rendered after Common Lisp. A lot of the choices, of course, for kind of function of the language are after that ilk. But it runs on the JVM, so it's a host platform is a JVM. It's built in Java as far as the compiler data structures are concerned. And, you know, not quite self-hosted yet, but, of course, a lot of the language is built in Clojure then as well, standard library and those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
There's even another language called Clojure Script, which is written entirely in Clojure, but compiles to JavaScript.
Of course, everything compiles to JavaScript.
That's
so
right.
I actually wanted to talk about that. So what are we going to do about the challenges of dynamic languages, and why are dynamic languages like JavaScript a challenge for security anyway?
You know, that's a really good question, right? The biggest part is the nature of the runtime. There's static analysis on dynamic languages is really tough. I love to use Ruby as an example for this because it's so ambiguous. Even just the language itself is ambiguous. You need a Turing complete parser just to parse the language.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a simple language, but the runtime is the important part. The metaprogramming, all those things that are kind of fun programmer tricks, make it just a bear to analyze.
Right.
Static analysis in these languages is tough because what you might see statically might not even get executed. It might be overwritten. The whole monkey patching idea in Ruby is crazy. at one point, I ended up writing code to tell me which function and which method on which file was actually getting called, because I had three methods that were all overriding the same one, but I didn't know which one was getting called because the load order was different.
Right. And there's sometimes no guarantees. I mean, Schema had that
no.
problem too. So the issue is if you have a dynamically scoped language like that, you have to figure out what's really going on at runtime, and it's very hard to compute statically what might go on. It's just too big of a set.
Yeah. Now, unless you restrict the parts of the language you're using to a subset. To give you a little bit more guarantee, but you know, let's say you're going to use Ruby on Rails, that all goes out the window because there's so much meta magic inside of Rails.
Right. So this move towards things like Node.js and everything compiles to JavaScript and all that jazz is going to be a challenge for us in software security.
Oh, certainly. But it's an unavoidable thing. You know, it's for a long time we kind of laughed at JavaScript kind of taking over and that really won't happen. This node thing's a toy, but you know, the more and more you see it, that's not true, right? It's real. You know, PayPal released a big part of their platform on Node.js. A lot of Groupon's infrastructure, front-end infrastructure, is running on Node.js. I mean, right. Some bigger companies with real traffic are using Node, and so it's not a toy anymore. It's something we have to actually consider, you know, valid at this point, and really sink some effort into.
Yeah,
and there's no good tools for JavaScript out there.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that movement, in if you stand way above it historically, it seems like we were making some great progress in software security from a languages perspective, and now it's all going to just get washed away.
Yeah.
In a big, giant tidal wave.
You know, there are some really great language tools for JavaScript out there. There's some good, you know, Esprima, the SpiderMonkey stuff. I mean, there's great analysis tools for the language and abstract syntax tree evaluation, those kind of things. But nobody's written a good call graph or call flow analysis engine. You know, until we get that, we really can't do real static analysis on JavaScript. We're going to have you know, just some kind of partway, you know, AST evaluation technique. So hopefully some of those tools will come out soon and we can start to really make some efforts at static analysis in JavaScript. You know, it's not going to be perfect, but it's better than having nothing at the moment.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. All right, let's talk about something even worse. So Heartbleed and the lessons we've yeah. learned. We just got done writing a thing for TechTarget. Thanks for doing that with me. That'll Certainly. Probably show up sometime this week. Why is OpenSSL such a mess? And what are we supposed to do about it? I mean, especially what's yeah. the open source community supposed to do about it?
Well, so I want to be very careful, right? I'm going to talk a little bit about OpenSSL, but I want to make sure that I load it up front with, these guys have a hard job.
Oh,
the OpenSSL team has a huge hard job, and yep. I don't want to rag on them too much because this is a really difficult thing to do.
Well, what, you said 80 platforms or something like that?
It's something like that, right? And I think that's the number one problem. Right? The problem is we have to cut some of the dead weight, right? VMS is not a thing we use a lot anymore. MS-DOS, DEC, like these things – yes, there might be support needed for them at some point, but I think it's time to let those go. And if they're needed, then somebody else can pick up the fork and move on with it. But mm-hmm. I don't think we need to carry the baggage with us anymore. I think we're really doing a disservice to moving forward and evolving the tooling by carrying around a lot of that dead weight.
Right, right. So that's one thing to do about it. And, I mean, we've already forked to the Libre SSL and all that stuff. So
yeah.
it's unclear exactly what the future holds, but I think one thing that's important is if you know what static analysis tools and other, maybe even fuzzers, if you know how they work and you know how to call them and you know what their limitations are, you can write code that that plays more nicely with the analysis tools that we have today.
Certainly,
than
yeah.
we are doing. And it seems like a lot of developer guys, I mean, they have a hard enough job getting the stuff to function, but if we taught them a little bit about how these analysis tools work, we might end up with higher quality from a security perspective just because yeah. the tools would be able to run.
You know, I think there's a halfway point, too, that we're missing, and that's the linting step, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think if the folks that were writing static analysis engines were also providing linting tools, and those are being run as kind of that preprocessor first step, I think that the outcome would be much more analyzable code because the linting tools would kind of say, hey, that's ambiguous, you should clear that up.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of would push code into a more analyzable fashion.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a huge fan of linting tools while I code just to make sure that things are kind of going along the right way.
And yeah, it's a better checker than just the compiler.
Yeah, and I want to give a shout out to Go. The Go language has a formatting and linting tool built in, and they're awesome. They're uh-huh. really great. I have them as save hooks in Emacs. Whenever I save a Go file, it just automatically goes ahead and does it for me.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that workflow is really nice. I wish we could get there with a few more languages.
So let's turn the corner a little bit on this. Vendor control is obviously a critical part of any sort of SSI. You got a software security
sure.
initiative. You got to know where the code's coming from. You got to know whether those guys know how to spell security and so on. How does open source factor into vendor control? And, if you're controlling all the people that build you software, but then your guys fork a project and slam it all into the code base, is anybody thinking about this as a vendor control problem?
Well, so I would say that people are certainly thinking about it, and it really comes in the form of review, right? Any project that's going to be public really should have, if you're going to pull in open source libraries, those kind of things, should have code review,
right?
I'm not saying you need to go out and audit the Linux kernel. Some companies are going to do that, but if you're going to pull in a library for your open source, that's open source for your projects, especially authentication libraries, those kind of more critical libraries, you want to review the code. And if you are not sure, if you really not quite confident they're doing what you think they should do, then that's when you call for help and have somebody else audit that for you and say, here's what we found, here's what we recommend.
Right. That's interesting.
Super important.
But the problem is, like we said before, sometimes the code base is so complicated and has such crazy control flow that the tools they can't even do it right. As an example, the perfect example is the OpenSSL code base, and Coverity had spent a long time doing some very good code review with their tool. Thanks, they did it for free and they allowed people to use their tool, which is super fantastic. But the code was so convoluted that it confused the tool, and so it didn't find a simple bug like Heartbleed because it didn't think it was reachable, even though
it
was.
That's, yep, That's very true, and I think that's one of the other big problems in OpenSSL is the code itself is kind of a mess. The LibreSSL project is doing some things to fix that. But it's going to be a long time. There's a lot of code there, and
I know
it's going to be a lot of work.
I know, and the thing is baked into a bunch of chips too, just to make life even more fun.
It sure is, man. it's really tough to. It's going to be many years before that the cleanup effort really goes underway. There's a half-life for a lot of this.
Now I'm depressed, so let's talk about something else. Super fast SDLCs, such as the one you guys use at Groupon, present some really serious challenges to software security, both in terms of tools and practices. So step one, explain the nature of the problem.
Sure. So I'll kind of even take it out one step higher and just talk about in particular, kind of what continuous deployment poses. Right?
Yes,
continuous deployment is kind of that holy grail of when I push code, it gets deployed.
Right.
Right. And it's not reckless deployment. It's not that every time I push code, it's just going to automatically be deployed. There's a system of checks that happens in the process. Right. And the more you have watching that, the better off you are, the less risk you have. Because it's going to happen. And it's really an awesome thing to be able to push code that easily. Because, you know, honestly, I'm a fan of pushing code as frequently as possible because you have less pressure built up in between releases, less to go wrong, and you can isolate on just those few changes you made.
Yeah.
You're not as likely to miss something big because there were 40,000 other changes that happened over
6 months.
Well,
you don't
right?
say when's the next bug release. You just say when's the next release.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just constantly being
and
released.
That day, right?
Yeah.
It's that day, that next hour, it's a couple hours from now, you're going to hit that. But at the same time, you don't have a chance to do the kind of review you'd like.
So talk about code review in particular. How do you do code review in a thing that's moving that fast?
First of all, a commit should never come in unless it has a peer review, right? Whether it was a pair that programmed together or somebody else that said, yeah, I saw that, we're good, go ahead and sync it to the master branch. I don't know, that's super important. Is another set of human eyes is step one.
Right.
I think, you know, even if something lightweight, you still need a static analysis tool to run on the builds. I don't think it's feasible to have, you know, some of the heavy hitters run their entire, you know, code base analysis every time somebody pushes code up. I do think there's some kind of in between lightweight tools, though. I mean, for me in Ruby universe, you know, at Breakman, I can do the whole project in less than a couple minutes, and that's great. But, you know, then again, there's a difference between Breakman and Fortify, you know,
right.
And what it's checking for and what it's actually going to be able to produce for you. So you need to have something, but there's also a middle ground of time versus findings and those kind of things. And backing that up with some dynamic analysis as well, right? That next step is when your build hits, passes all its tests, passes static analysis, your CI environment should be able to deploy your code.
Mm-hmm.
Right away
mm-hmm.
To a staging environment or a CI environment, right? And then kick off the dynamic scan against that.
Right. So it should have a dynamic section too.
Of course, absolutely.
So static and dynamic I'm all good with, and we understand how those things can be automated. What we don't understand is how to automate architecture analysis or think about flaws the same way we think about bugs. So what do you
absolutely.
Do about that in a CI super fast-paced thing?
So I think this is where the DevOps world becomes a real thing and something we have to spend significant time improving, right? I know that from an architecture standpoint, we have Puppet, Chef, those kind of things that deploy our infrastructure and our systems and actually do define the boundaries. You see where connections happen. You can start to define the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think with additional growth and additional kind of features into Chef and Puppet, you could also define trust boundaries and communication protocols and eliminate other communication protocols that shouldn't happen, right?
Right.
I think there's a way, I think these infrastructure tools and these DevOps tools should give us what we need, the leverage that we need to automate ARA. And I think, I mean, nothing like that exists yet, but
right.
my dream would be to start to build these into these tools and make Chef and Puppet first-class architecture analysis tools as well.
Uh-huh. And then you can get dev groups to use the right kind of patterns as well, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
And so those things align.
You predefine them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And then it should produce a graph, right? Like drawings. These architecture risk analysis has these big drawings. I should be able to spit one out that's pretty close.
Right.
Based on just my Puppet or Chef configuration, and you fill in the questions.
Uh huh. Now that'd be interesting. So the golden age of architecture analysis here in about 2 days or so, right?
Of course. I mean, you know, ticking. Time's ticking. But you know.
Pen testing. So you managed. You talked about dynamic testing, and in some sense, pen testing is a subset of that, but it's a special kind of dynamic testing.
Sure.
Would you do that in the CI environment before you ship, or how do you? What do you do about that?
That's tough because I mean, for me, pen testing means there's at least there's a human on the other side of that helping facilitate.
Right.
You know, you can run AppScanner, you can run Burp scan or Qualys scan or whatever, but that's for me. That's an automated thing. That's a quick dynamic scan, and that's going to be, you know, that's brain dead, right? It's automated. But for me, a pen test means more than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to follow up with pen tests. You know, there's a once a week pen test or once a month pen test. Or
yep.
There's got to be some feasible window where a human based pen test is still happening, and that's got to be a kind of a regular heartbeat,
mm-hmm.
unless there's something really big that you know is going to be going out soon, right? Huge new feature, huge new site, something monumental. You know, at that point, you know it's coming. You can kind of plan for it, and there is a time where you can really kind of get out ahead of it.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the pen test follows kind of closely in tow with the releases,
mm-hmm.
and all the other controls that are in place, all the other things that are there, are meant to catch the big stuff. You know, the pen test might find something here or there, but you know, those other things should be able to at least catch the major stuff, so that by the time you get to it, you're leaving yourself exposed. There's a little bit of risk there, but it's all about closing that gap on the risk
yeah.
in between with the extra pieces.
All right, so you've laid out a vision of, you know, a super fast SDLC, continuous integration, DevOps integrated with some security stuff in there, and I think the vision is good. The real question is, where do we sit today with that stuff?
Like, sure.
What's your opinion about that?
we have a lot of the tools available. You know, there are dynamic scanners. There are tools you can run with to do manual pen testing, and you know, partially automated pen testing. There are CI tools in place. There's all this stuff exists, but it exists independent of each other. And so you kind of have to build your own automation. Your build pipeline is your own, basically. And so you end up plugging things together, right? I do love the Jenkins environment. I use that for most of my things. But you still have to build your own automation in a lot of cases.
Right.
And so we're left kind of holding the bag. And unless you have somebody that really can dedicate themselves full time to building this automation and teams that really are into this, you know, it's difficult to get it going. And of course, DevOps being another thing, right, that build and infrastructure automation has to be part of this to make it all work.
Right, right. So we got a ways to go before we get to our golden vision.
I think we have a long ways to go, yeah.
Oh, that's always the problem with software security is there's too much to do at all times. next to last thing, do you have any music projects underway these days?
You know, I'm starting to build a home studio in the new house, and I think I'll be kicking off some new stuff pretty soon. There are some pretty great folks in Chicago when it comes to music.
Uh-huh.
That's no surprise, of course. I've been getting together a little bit with them, and hopefully maybe do some stuff soon. Trying to maybe put some throwbacks to, you know, Billy Cobham and you know, the Red Baron days and those kind of things.
Cool.
You know, I've always been some of my favorite pieces. So, you know, I want to get back into that. And of course, Chicago will support that as being kind of the staple of the city.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right.
That kind of music.
Right. And then the last thing, what's the latest nonfiction book that you have read?
Latest nonfiction book
yeah,
that
nonfiction.
I read.
Nonfiction. This always stumps the geeks. They're like, I only read real books.
You know, actually, Accelerando was the last one I read.
Oh, wow.
You recommended that to me.
And
so.
You read it. Good. Did you like it?
Yeah. It was great. I liked it a lot. It was actually a lot more relevant and in tune than other books of that genre.
Yeah, and it was written quite a long time ago, but there are, you know, 7 or 8 good ideas in that book.
Yeah.
Like, particularly good ideas. All right, cool. Well, you heard it here first or third or second or something like that. Thanks for your time, Aaron.
Thank you.
It's been an interesting conversation today.
Absolutely. Thanks.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on moving targets, edited by Carl Landwehr and Luann Goldrich. The issue also includes our conversation with Matthew Green from Johns Hopkins. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigil.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.